It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, National Public Radio favorite Sarah Vowell is here with a look at one of the United States' first celebrities, the Marquis de Lafayette.
First, the House of Representatives elected Wisconsin's Paul Ryan to the role of Speaker today. At second in the line of succession to the presidency, it's the highest federal office a Wisconsinite has ever held. Also at 45 years old, Ryan is the youngest Speaker since 1869.
Paul Ryan addressed the House this morning.
I never thought I'd be Speaker. But early in my life, I wanted to serve this house. I thought this place was exhilarating because here you can make a difference. Only a fully functioning house can truly represent the people. And if there were ever a time for us to step up, this would be that time.
Speaker Paul Ryan from Janesville is inheriting one of the most inactive houses in history, locked in partisanship since 2011.
Here with us now to talk about it is Craig Gilbert, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief. Craig, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
Well, the House Speaker is not the role Paul Ryan has been seeking out all these years. In fact, he's been called one of the most reluctant speakers of all time. So how did he end up running for it and getting this job?
Well, he was somebody that his caucus turned to because there was really nobody else. And he is well-liked, and he did have a reputation. He has stature in the House. He's a former vice presidential nominee. And, you know, he had really performed some of the tasks that a speaker performs as the chairman of two committees, the Budget Committee and the Ways and Means Committee. He had rallied support in his caucus behind controversial legislation. He'd raised a lot of money. He's a smart politician. He's a smart legislator. He's good with the media. So they saw somebody who had the skills, but they also saw sort of like the only person around that had stature and that could potentially unify the caucus, which is more or less what happened.
And he addressed the House this morning. What did he have to say?
Well, it was interesting. He spoke for about 13 minutes. It was, one of those days when there was sort of good feeling across the aisle, in the House. I mean, it was, it's an historic event when there's a new speaker. And like I said, he is a collegial guy who's well-liked by both Republicans and Democrats, even though Democrats really don't like his policies. They like him personally. And John Boehner went out with, sort of good feeling as well. And so it was a chance for people to kind of indulge in a little brotherhood and sisterhood, which doesn't happen very often in the House. And he played to that too. Paul Ryan spoke about, he asked Democrats and Republicans to pray for each other. He said, we're all in the same boat. He told people that this would be a new House. It would be run in some new ways and some old ways, meaning the committees would once again be able to exercise their sort of policy expertise and actually legislate, and everything wouldn't be dictated from the top down. And he asked members to sort of be open and honest about their differences and embrace their differences, and let's have a, kind of a big debate of ideas without hating each other.
Right. He didn't exactly, as far as I could tell anyway, use the word bipartisanship, but he did say it was time to accept and embrace differences. Does that hint that there will be more working across the aisle in the future, or is this just sort of the optimism of rhetoric?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, the Ryan sort of formula is let's draw sharp contrasts in terms of ideas, in terms of policies. There's big differences between the party. He's never been shy about those differences. His argument is that, the party should take their differences, underline them, take them to the voters and see which side wins. But at the same time, let's be civil and collegial and try to get along and try to function. And he put a lot of emphasis in his speech on that second part, which is we've got to make this place work. And he basically said it's an embarrassment and it's mortifying to our constituents who are out there struggling when they see the chaos that we've fallen into and the fact that we can't get our jobs done.
So what do you think his election is going to mean for Wisconsin?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's obviously, on paper, a good thing in the sense that, when other members of the Wisconsin delegation have issues that they care about, they're certainly going to get a hearing with the new speaker. And he's somebody that's voted his district on some issues in the past as well. But, in this day and age, there is a limit to what I think a speaker can do for his state and his district. It's not the same institution it was 10, 15 years ago. You don't have earmarks. You don't have the kind of pork barrel politics that we used to have. So I think, and I'm not sure Paul Ryan is that kind of legislator either. So he is mindful of his constituents and mindful of constituent service, and I think it's certainly not a bad thing for Wisconsin to have its first ever speaker. But it probably doesn't mean as quite as much as it might have, you know, in a Congress of 20 or 40 years ago.
Do you have any sense about how this move for Paul Ryan is going over in Janesville, his hometown?
Well, I haven't been to Janesville. I was back in Wisconsin over the weekend in another part of Wisconsin. And I think, you know, my sense is certainly that there's a lot of interest. I mean, he's, you know, he's fairly popular in the state. You know, he's the last time that a good poll was done on his statewide numbers, he had a positive image, more positive than a lot of other politicians. And the danger is that he'll get, you know, the danger to his image is that he will get polarized because of the nature of his position. This sort of happened when he was on the ticket with Mitt Romney in the 2012 presidential race. He's going to try to resist that. But I do think that right now he starts with some goodwill. Just as he has goodwill among Democrats across the aisle, I think he's got goodwill back home. I'm sure there's a sense of pride and a sense of interest. He had about 200 people from his congressional district who came out to Washington to watch all this, obviously, including his family and extended family. So I think there is a lot of interest.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert right now with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the news that Wisconsin's own Paul Ryan has been elected to the role of Speaker of the House. Now, looking at 2014, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor lost his seat as Speaker after being beaten by a primary challenger. Does Paul Ryan have anything to worry about in terms of popularity, do you think, in his district?
Well, you know, it's a fair question to ask only because his district, it's not a 50-50 district, but it's not an 80-20 district either. It's a district that he's always won very comfortably, but not, you know, his margin when he was on the presidential ticket in 2012 got smaller, again, because he became a more polarizing figure as a result of that race. I don't think he's in danger of losing a race at home. He's always been great at constituent relations. He's always spent a lot of time back in the district. He's talking about continuing to do that, but it does, you know, it could change his image back in his district in for better or for worse. I mean, this is a high-profile position, and there are some risks associated with it.
Now, looking at challenges that are going to be on Paul Ryan's plate, Speaker Boehner did some heavy lifting that Paul Ryan would have had to do in terms of the budget and reaching a deal there. So with that in the rearview mirror, what's first for Paul Ryan in terms of what he's got to handle and tackle?
Well, he's got to figure out, I think he's got to task his members in a lot of different ways. He's talking about restoring power to the committees, and he's got to figure out how that's going to work. He did get a little leeway and a little space thanks to the way former Speaker Boehner cleaned out the barn, quote unquote. So that, I'm sure he's, even though he expressed mixed feelings about the budget deal, he voted for it. I'm sure he's grateful for it. It buys him a little space, but, you know, there are still appropriations bills that have to be drafted, have to be shaped and debated and passed. There's a big highway bill hanging out there that needs to be done. There's a lot of things across the map. There's a trade bill that Paul Ryan is a huge advocate of that has to be legislated. And so there's a lot on his plate, and I'm sure some things that we don't even anticipate right now.
So now that he's Speaker of the House, the trajectory forward in terms of a political career looks more like a wild card. How do you think this is going to affect where he might go next?
Well, so one school of thought is that, you know, the speakership is really the end of a career, not the beginning of a career. And traditionally that's been true. I mean, it's been both something that's gone to more senior lawmakers who had this ambition and worked toward it and achieved it, and then they went home. It's very rare to stay in the House after a speakership. I mean, Nancy Pelosi has done it, but, you know, none of the recent Republican speakers have. But he's young, and so he, in theory, has a lot of political future ahead of him. He's only 45, and he's also someone who's considered a potential presidential candidate. It's just that the speakership has been kind of a career killer in modern times. And so he would have to go against the grain of recent speakers. And certainly if he prospers or even sort of survives his speakership, he would be well positioned to run for president again someday. You know, it's harder to imagine him returning to the House as a regular member after serving as a speaker, even though he gave up his dream job of the Ways and Means Committee. I mean, the speakership is, that would be a step down at this point. So, you know, I think that there's still, you know, and these things are hard to predict, but he still can harbor thoughts about running for president at his age, provided he can make something of a job that a lot of people consider almost undoable.
Craig, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, anytime.
That's Craig Gilbert, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief, talking about the news that Wisconsin's Paul Ryan has been elected Speaker of the House. The American history that we're taught is often filled with heroic deeds and noble people. Some of that's true, but the real history, with all the twists, the turns, even the failures, can be more interesting and even inspiring.
Sarah Vowell is adept at bringing out the complexities and humor of our country's early years, and her latest book is no exception. It's called Lafayette in the Somewhat United States. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, there are a lot of characters in early American history, and I mean character in every sense of the word. Why did you decide to focus this book on the Marquis de Lafayette?
I mean, in the beginning, way back when I started the thing, it had as much to do with the American people's regard for Lafayette as his own story. I originally wrote a short piece about his return visit to the United States in 1824 as an old man coming back as the last living general from the Continental Army coming over from France. And it was such a huge big deal, that trip. It lasted over a year, and more than half the population of New York City met his ship. And originally, I was just so attracted to how Americans agreed about him. Mm-hmm. I mean, by 1824, you know, the Civil War is kind of starting to simmer to the surface, and the North and the South are ever more divided, and the left and the right, as always, and the whole country just welcomed him as one, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that seemed exotic. I mean, I was just listening to your news broadcast, you know. I mean, there's always so much contention, especially in terms of our elected officials and the country. We're constantly told how divided we are, and I suppose there's a lot of evidence for that. So originally I just thought, oh, how nice it would be to write about someone all Americans once loved. And then I started the research, and once he gets here, I mean, every step of the story, there's just squabbling and bickering amongst the founding fathers, between the Continental Congress and the Continental Army. Then when he comes back in 1824, there's a big contentious presidential election. Everyone, all the American factions are at each other's throats, at least rhetorically. And then when I started researching the book, it coincided with the government shutdown of 2013, mm-hmm. and I couldn't visit historic sites administered by the federal government because they were closed because, you know, the government our founders founded was based on a separation of powers, and sometimes that leads to, you know, separation. So Lafayette, the thing that drew me to him, I kept coming up against the flip side of that, you know, that there's never been any agreement. I mean, in your newscast just now, you're talking about the chaos within just the Republican Party, and that's very American, you know. I mean, even in writing about the late 18th century, the Quakers are a complete mess. You know, some of them are still neutral and nonviolent. And
right, and then there are the fighting Quakers, too.
Yeah, and some of them are fighting in the militias and the army. So this kind of splintered quality of our culture goes back to the founding. And Lafayette is, I mean, it's just that every time I try to pinpoint him somewhere on the space-time continuum to talk about the context of some battle or some diplomatic event between America and France, there's always this sort of disorderly buzzing behind him.
So I do think that Lafayette is a fascinating character in that kind of victory lap of the United States in the early 19th century. But for him to do that victory lap, he had to first come that first time. And Lafayette came to offer his services to the American Revolution at an incredibly young age. He was only 19 years old.
That's right.
And he was an orphan and an aspiring military man. So here he arrives, and there is General George Washington in front of him, a father figure and a military mentor all rolled into one. Tell us about their relationship in the beginning.
Well, at first, you know, this is it's another year or so before there's an official alliance between France and the American rebels, and the rebels have sent Ben Franklin to France to lobby the French government to provide material aid to the colonists. And so when Lafayette arrives in Philadelphia, because he is an aristocrat and he comes from the court of Versailles, and he, you know, knows Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette well enough that he has stepped on Marie Antoinette's toes on the dance floor, at first the Continental Congress just lets him participate because they're trying to butter up the folks back home for money. And Washington is skeptical at first, but very quickly Lafayette just rolls up his sleeves and gets cracking and pitches in, and all he wants is for his coach to put him in the game. Meanwhile, you know, Washington's army is continually deserting him in droves because that army is so underfunded and underfed, and here's this kid, and even though he has this fancy background and he is so young, he all he wants to do is help and participate, and because Lafayette's an orphan and Washington had no biological children of his own, they quickly kind of have this father-son relationship, and then it's further deepened because of the divides within the American side, and many army officers and Continental congressmen want to fire George Washington, and Lafayette is with Washington from the get-go and constantly bucking up Washington and, you know, giving Washington his full support. So, and then as, you know, finally the war comes to an end and George Washington finally becomes George Washington, the fact that Lafayette was so beloved to Washington and such a stalwart friend and son figure, that certainly deepened the sentimental aspects of the Americans' relationship with Lafayette.
We're talking with Sarah Vowell about her new book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States. And I really like that you bring out that here's George Washington. He's older. He's, you know, from a more kind of staid background. And then you have this young, really exuberant Frenchman. And they clearly had this very strong affection for each other, but they expressed it in really different ways.
Washington was a bit more stoic than Lafayette, but I think that's true of just about everybody. I mean, he was very effusive. I mean, I think some of that came from him, from his youth, but some of it came from being an orphan and an only child. And Jefferson described Lafayette's canine appetite for affection, and he does have this kind of puppy dog quality. And, you know, Washington was more, had more of an old dog quality, I guess you could say. So, but the letters, I mean, Lafayette is so effusive in his letters that Washington does kind of soften up and return Lafayette's affection as much as he can.
You bring out the irony that the American rebels were asking for help from a monarchy in France to help them break free from another monarchy, that in England. What was in it for the French?
Hate, revenge. I mean, they just, the animosity between the British and the French went back hundreds of years, and you know, at least starting with the Norman conquering of England in 1066. And you know, the one reason Lafayette was an orphan was that his soldier father had been killed in the previous war, which the Europeans call the Seven Years' War, and we call the French and Indian War. And so the French were still broke from that war and completely humiliated. And at first, I mean, it takes a while for them to enter into an official alliance with the Americans, but before that, because they don't want to provoke the British into a full-on war, so they're kind of, for a while, they're just channeling money and supplies to the rebels on the sly, and the whole reason for it is because it's the whole the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I mean, it makes no sense for this absolute monarch to be funding and eventually throwing in with these Republican rebels, but that's how deeply the French loathed the British. I mean, remember when France used to own Canada? Well, they still hadn't gotten over losing that, for one thing. So they were just still so humiliated from the last war, and they just hated Great Britain so deeply that, you know, they could get past the fact that they loathed pretty much everything the rebels stood for. Not Lafayette. He was one of those Frenchmen who was caught up in Enlightenment ideals, mm-hmm. about justice and liberty. But the government of France, they really had no business helping out these anti-monarchist punks, you know.
We have just about a minute left, Sarah, and I want to make sure we let people know about the events you have this weekend.
Oh, yeah.
So you'll be in Madison tomorrow and you'll be in Milwaukee on Saturday.
That's right.
And we'll make sure that information is up on Facebook. Sarah Vowell, thanks so much for chatting with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Sarah Vowell's most recent book is Lafayette in the Somewhat United States, and she'll be visiting Madison tomorrow and Milwaukee on Saturday.
Many aspects of parenting are viewed as vital for the physical and emotional health of children, but few evoke such strong feelings and moral judgments as breastfeeding.
While few would dispute that breastfeeding can be an opportunity to bond with a new baby and to provide solid nutrition early in life, the reality is that not all women can breastfeed, and some of the determining factors are economic status and public policy.
Joining us now to unravel the issues that surround breastfeeding is Courtney Young. Her upcoming book is called Lactivism: How Feminists and Fundamentalists, Hippies and Yuppies, and Physicians and Politicians Made Breastfeeding Big Business and Bad Policy. And a link to a recent New York Times opinion piece called Overselling Breastfeeding is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Courtney, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much.
Well, you start your piece by sharing your own experience of just barely being in a position where you're showing your pregnancy and people offering their opinions about breastfeeding. What kinds of stuff did people say to you?
Well, they were very eager to make sure that I was going to breastfeed, and they wanted to explain the benefits of breastfeeding, which ranged from bonding benefits to, you know, to all of the health conditions, the dangerous health conditions that I could reduce the risk of through breastfeeding, like, you know, ranging from cancer and Crohn's disease to infections, diabetes, asthma, et cetera. So they, you know, in general, they just wanted to make sure that I knew what all the benefits of breastfeeding were and that I would not be misguided on this topic.
And then you got to a point where the class that you were taking at a hospital said they wouldn't even tell you how formula worked, how that would factor in. So where were you at that point on the whole breastfeeding thing?
Well, at that point, you know, it had never really occurred to me not to breastfeed. But the truth was I hadn't given it a great deal of thought. I was pregnant with my first child. And, you know, I'd always just assumed that breastfeeding was just, you know, one way somebody might choose to feed a baby. And I didn't realize all of the how strongly people felt about breastfeeding. And, you know, in general, I just couldn't understand why people had any interest at all in how anybody might feed their baby. So then at the hospital, it wasn't that I had any particular interest in formula feeding, but one of the other women in the class made clear that she wasn't going to be able to breastfeed, and she wanted information about formula feeding. And the person who was teaching the prenatal class just flatly refused to even discuss it, and she said it was against hospital regulations. I think that she was actually mistaken about that. I don't think that was against hospital regulations, but that was how she avoided the topic.
Now, a few sentences ago, you used the word choose, that this would be one way you would choose to feed a baby, breastfeeding, the other way being formula, and sometimes it's just necessity. But do you think that our culture views it that way, sees it as a choice, or does our culture see it as something different?
Well, I mean, there's culture and there's public policy, right? So, I mean, the strongest indicator of the fact that it's clearly not seen as a choice comes from, you know, recent initiatives in the last 3 or 4 years to turn breastfeeding into a public health issue. And now that it's a public health issue, and that's, you know, that's an official designation that is that the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and the U.S. Surgeon General have all decided that that breastfeeding is a public health issue. And when it becomes a public health issue, part of the reason to officially identify breastfeeding or the failure to breastfeed as a public health issue is to draw attention to that. And so, for example, what the director of the section on breastfeeding of the American Academy of Pediatrics issued the press statement connected to turning breastfeeding into a public health issue, and he said clearly it's not what this means is that it's not should you or shouldn't you. Of course you should. Breastfeeding is important for the health of our children, and it's important that we advocate strongly for it. And other, you know, heads of organizations and public health officials echoed that statement, basically saying, you know, that what's good about turning it into a public health issue is making sure that people realize that it's not a choice.
Well, so there's this public health mandate. So where does the United States fall among other countries in terms of our rates of breastfeeding?
Well, in the U.S., 79% of women initiate breastfeeding. And so that is not so far off what the rates are in other advanced, you know, Western countries. Canada, the rate is 89%. But at 6 months, in the United States, 49% of women are breastfeeding, and in Canada, it's just over 50%. So, you know, comparing the U.S. and Canada, you've got rough parity, not in terms of initiation, but certainly in terms of how many women keep on breastfeeding for any length of time. Norway, of course, is much higher. Norway, the Nordic country, the, you know, that's where we always hear of people breastfeeding for, you know, everybody breastfeeding and breastfeeding for long periods of time. But the UK and France are much lower than the United States. So, you know, the U.S. is not an outlier among countries that, you know, we would often consider to be sort of the relevant comparisons.
We're talking to Courtney Young right now. She's the author of the new book called Lactivism. And Courtney, among the statistics that you just mentioned about the United States, how does that break down by factors of race and class?
It breaks down, it's very different by race and class. So among women who, the women who are most likely to be breastfeeding in the United States are white, older, married, and have higher levels of education and to be in the highest socioeconomic bracket. And so the women who are not breastfeeding tend to be poor, African American, and single.
And so, given these numbers, there is, as you said, this public health push to get more people to breastfeed, and the accepted wisdom is that it's good for the baby, that there are clear-cut health benefits. And you went and you looked closely at this medical research. What did you find?
Well, that's exactly where my concern lay, right? I mean, it's one thing to identify something like smoking as a public health issue, as something that, you know, we should really get involved in having people stop smoking. Because I think that the research on the dangers of smoking is probably, you know, pretty strong and, you know, at this point, I think irrefutable. But the research associated with the benefits of breastfeeding is not that strong at all. So, you know, I mean, I don't know, you know, how many people think about this, but when you look at the list of things that is associated with breastfeeding, the list of things that allegedly you can decrease the risk of through breastfeeding, it's extensive. It includes not only infections, but also asthma, allergies, Crohn's disease, diabetes, obesity, some cancers, cardiovascular disease, eczema, and on the other side of the scale, increasing a child's IQ or cognitive development. And in fact, the evidence for breastfeeding research in general is weakened by the fact that almost all of it is all of it, in fact, is observational. You cannot do randomized controlled trials on breastfeeding because you cannot, it's not ethical or even feasible for doctors or researchers to randomly sort women into breastfeeding and non-breastfeeding cohorts. Women have preferences about how they're going to feed their babies, and they're not, you know, likely to be randomly sorted that way. And so all of the studies on breastfeeding benefits are observational, and that makes them much weaker than a lot of standard scientific evidence that we rely on, which is mostly done, you know, most of the research is done through randomized control trials. Breastfeeding research is weaker because it's observational. So you need to control for other factors that could have had an impact on the outcome that you're studying. So, for example, if mothers who breastfeed are also much more likely to be in higher socioeconomic brackets and have better access to health care and also are less likely to smoke, any one of those factors could be actually what is contributing to the better health outcomes and not breastfeeding itself. So that's part of, you know, there's a whole way in which a lot of the research itself is not as strong as other medical research. But in fact, as this research advances, you know, they're finding more and more that the associations the things we commonly associate with reducing the risk of through breastfeeding are not, they've been disproven, or they're very close to being disproven, or it looks less and less likely that it's true. There's more and more research coming out that says, for example, that it's very unlikely that breastfeeding has an impact on obesity. It's very unlikely that it has an impact on asthma and allergies. I think now that people basically agree, or, you know, studies are accumulating to show that there's no evidence of an effect on type 1 diabetes. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality estimates that there's no, you know, having reviewed the literature, they think it's unlikely that there's an effect on cardiovascular disease. I think there is an effect on infections. And, of course, when I say I think there is an effect, it's not my opinion I'm referring to. It's, you know, the balance of the literature, the medical research in the literature, seems to show that there is, that breastfeeding has an effect on reducing the risk of ear, gastrointestinal, and lung infections during the period that the baby is actually breastfeeding.
We're talking with Courtney Young right now about her New York Times piece called Overselling Breastfeeding. And we want to hear from you. Were you able to breastfeed your children? What were some of the barriers? Or did you feel that you had the support that you needed? Did you ever feel guilty or bad because you couldn't breastfeed? Do you think there should be, or is there, pressure that you perceive to breastfeed? Call in right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation with Courtney Young about her New York Times piece, Overselling Breastfeeding. And we want to hear from you. Do you think there's too much emphasis on breastfeeding in our country? Do you think there needs to be more support for moms who want to breastfeed? Or do you think there are plenty of accommodations being made already? Join in by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
And we go to our callers now. We have Emily on the line in Wanakee. Hi, Emily.
Hi. I was just going to mention that I've had two children, and one of them, actually both of them, went through C-section. But the first one was because they had preeclampsia, and I just couldn't produce enough milk to breastfeed. And I felt from the nursing staff and mainly women around me that it was not the best choice. I felt like I was being judged quite a bit.
Emily, thank you for that. I've got a little bit of distortion on your line, but you were saying that you were not able to produce enough milk with preeclampsia, and you felt judgment from women, and I think you mentioned some nurses as well, just or questioning of your judgment, I should say. And Courtney, would you say that is something that some women encounter when they can't breastfeed?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things that's really personally sad about this for people is that there are a lot of women, you know, experts estimate that up to 15% of women cannot produce enough milk to feed their babies. And the reasons range from a condition called hypoplasia, which is actually fairly common, which means, you know, basically women don't produce enough milk. Thyroid conditions can complicate milk production. There are complications in childbirth, which often impede full milk production. And some women are on medications that haven't been, that have never been tested for safety with breastfeeding. So there are a lot of situations where women actually simply cannot breastfeed. And the idea that we have that all women can breastfeed, which is what breastfeeding advocates tell people, what most women believe and understand, it's very painful. It makes those things that happen in the aftermath of giving birth, when women are very, very vulnerable anyway, it makes it all much more painful. Because if you say that all women can breastfeed and you find yourself as a new mother in a situation where, you know, maybe you fully expected to breastfeed and you can't, then you obviously, you know, there's nowhere to go other than for you to feel like you're doing something terribly, terribly wrong.
Well, Emily, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate that. And we go next to Elizabeth in Fish Creek. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. Well, I'll start by saying that, of course, when we're speaking about the social issue of women feeling judged when they're in a position where they aren't breastfeeding, of course, we need to be mindful of that, and there's a multitude of different reasons why a woman might not be breastfeeding. However, we seem to be mixing two things up here. That is one issue. The other issue is a legitimate conversation about the healthfulness of breastfeeding. Do we, under a circumstance where it is possible, choose that first and foremost? I have to say, Courtney, it feels like you found yourself a hot topic. And I'm going to try to say this gently in a friendly way, but it feels like your knowledge is a mile wide and an inch deep.
Well, I think that's...
I'm going to
jump in, Elizabeth. I think that's maybe getting a little personal. But Courtney, what about the issues that Elizabeth raised there about the choice and whether it's helpful to breastfeed ultimately?
I think that under some conditions, you know, my position on breastfeeding is basically I'm not at all opposed to breastfeeding, but I think that we need a lot better information about exactly where breastfeeding is beneficial and where it isn't. And so I think we need to get to a place where the conversation is actually based on what the actual medical benefits are of breastfeeding, what we know and what we don't know. So my concern is that what we don't know is a lot more than what we think we know. And a lot of the benefits that have been ascribed to breastfeeding actually don't exist. So I think that the benefits of breastfeeding absolutely include reducing the risk of infection. So then people will make cost-benefit analyses. They'll make decisions that are based on accurate understandings of what we know about the benefits of breastfeeding, as opposed to, you know, hyperbolic constructions of breastfeeding as something that is that's going to protect our children from almost everything. You know, as new parents, all of us want to protect our kids, and none of us really know how. And breastfeeding seems like something that we can do that will, you know, that will work for so many different things, and that's just not true. There are a lot of other things that we could be doing out there. And so when women make the choice to breastfeed, I think, you know, women in the U.S. need a heck of a lot more support when they do want to breastfeed, but they also need space or better information so that they can actually make decisions that best complement their lives and the constraints that they're experiencing themselves, their lives, their families, their needs, their baby's needs, etc.
And Courtney, we've just got about 30 seconds left, but what do you want women to take away from some of this research and what you've been talking about today?
I want to open the space back up for choice. The choice element is something that I feel has really disappeared from this argument or from breastfeeding advocacy. You know, the very fact that it's been turned into a public health issue undermines the idea that women should have choice.
Courtney, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today. That was Courtney Young. You can read her New York Times piece, Overselling Breastfeeding, at the Central Time Facebook page. And you can leave your comments there as well and keep that conversation going.